Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series. For those of you who don't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how spiritual practice and higher levels of consciousness can play a key role in helping human beings rise to the challenges of our world crises and to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. I've been holding, at this point, over 50 profound and enlivening conversations on this topic with many of today's leading spiritual teachers and thought leaders. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This morning, I'm delighted to be joined by James Barrows for a special broadcast event where we'll be continuing that discussion in a conversation entitled Awakening Doi. The way this will work is I'll introduce James, and then he and I will dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements, and then we'll spend about half an hour taking your questions. So we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. James Barrows was an early student of Ram Dass and among the earliest of the second generation of Western meditation teachers. He's a founding teacher at Spirit Rock Meditation Center, and he's taught meditation retreats, classes, and workshops in the United States and abroad since 1980. He serves on the International Advisory Board of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, but his original work centers on joy and happiness. His online and in-person Awakening Joy course, which you can find at awakeningjoy.info, has now graduated over 10,000 participants. It's been featured in O, the Oprah Magazine, in Yoga Journal, Tricycle, and the Huffington Post. He's the co-author of the book Awakening Joy, 10 Steps That Will Put You on the Road to Real Happiness. He lives with his wife, Jane, in Berkeley, California, and has two sons and three grandchildren. What I particularly love about James is that he cleaves utterly faithfully to the most direct, simple, and profound Dharma, the Dharma of the heart. Being in his presence is always a joy for me because kindness keeps showing up. A quiet joy keeps bubbling forth. Patient innocence keeps showing up, not showy, not needing to prove a thing. And if you pay attention, you'll notice that his GPS consistently keeps navigating every little turn in a conversation or a social situation or a business situation based on what his heart feels and cares about, based on care and compassion for himself, for you, and as Buddhist practitioners say, for all sentient beings. So it is a sincere joy to welcome you, James, as my guest today.
Oh, thank you very much, Terry. Wow, I hope I live up to that introduction. and it is a pleasure to be here with you, and I always enjoy and find very intellectually stimulating and heart connecting when we have conversations.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, you know, it seems like the best way to begin might be for me to invite you to tell us how it came about that you decided to focus your teaching on this particular theme, awakening joy. You know, there are many ways of expressing the essence of the Dharma: mindful clarity, compassionate service, non-attachment, loving kindness. And you've arrived at awakening joy. How did that come about?
Well, as you said, I've been teaching and involved with Buddhist practice primarily, teaching Buddhist meditation and philosophy for the last 30 years. And for the first few years of my practice, I found what I was looking for. It was my salvation, and I was on a long honeymoon, as it's sometimes said. And then at some point, I became very serious. I became a very serious practitioner, as you might say, dead serious. And I lost a lot of my vitality and aliveness, somehow distorting the teachings within myself to think that it's not okay to really love life and enjoy life, and we've got to get off the wheel as quickly as we can. And there's a number of teachings that can be taken that way, but when I reclaim my joy and realized I had distorted a few teachings in my heart, even more than in my conceptual mind, I wanted to look and see what the Buddha actually said about happiness, and he has some really profound teachings on not only happiness, but how to develop it off the cushion as well as on the cushion. So in my exploration, I realized I wasn't alone in my seriousness of practice, and wanted to share what the Buddha talked about as far as going for real happiness. And that's how the Joy Course started, and writing about it, and seeing that I could actually share some principles and practices that made a difference.
Okay, and yet that personal interest wasn't. I've heard you talk also about how much you saw this being of importance to others, and how your own lesson was maybe part of how you fastened on it, you know, in that most personal way. But It wasn't just about yourself.
Oh, no. Well, you know, clearly I wasn't alone in this predicament. And also, when I looked at the teachings, the Buddha was called the Happy One. And he said, go for the highest happiness, and you'll have all the other real happinesses. It's important to see where happiness lies. The Dalai Lama says the purpose of life is to be happy. When you think about that, the Dalai Lama saying the purpose of our life is to be happy, how is that so? Well, if you think about it, when you're around somebody who radiates well-being and love and genuine ease and contentment within themselves, it's contagious. And so I realized that going around feeling depressed and cynical or not connected is not doing anybody else a service, let alone not feeling so good inside. So I realized that this is the best gift that you can give the world, is to come and get in touch with your own genuine well-being, and that becomes, it's like joy and goodness and love awakening itself through us. One heart touches another, and the joy doesn't belong to me or anybody else. It's just finding itself. And when I talk about joy, I'm not necessarily talking about skipping through a field of daisies and, yes, isn't it all wonderful? Happy people aren't happy all the time. So when I talk about it, I'm really talking about all states of well-being, which are sourced in feeling connected to your heart, feeling authentic, being authentically right where you are, and out of that comes an aliveness that is engaged with life. And so that can't help but have positive ripples out.
Okay. Now, one of the things that we talked about before, when we kind of contemplated doing this broadcast together, is to talk about the focus of the series, how higher consciousness can enable us to rise to meet these really powerful objective challenges of our time. And so I think it might be helpful for you right from the beginning to connect those dots. How does this practice of awakening our own innate joy really help us to be of service to one another, to rise to the challenges of a very, unprecedented challenges to the whole human species? How is that relevant? How is that right at the center of the bullseye?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I look at the people who really inspire me to action, like the Dalai Lama or Desmond Tutu or other figures like that, Julia Butterfly Hill is another person, contemporary person, or Joanna Macy, they are in touch with a real well-being that that allows to laugh, allows them to see the goodness in life. You know, as they say, life is made of 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. And if you just focus on what's wrong, it's a very depressing worldview. But if you can see what's wrong in the context of what's right, and you get in touch with how much you love life, then you're not coming from a place of fear, which is a much more magnetizing and inspiring energy to touch other people. I love this. In my book, I have a quote from Howard Zinn, who the great historian who didn't whitewash our history and said, okay, let's be real here about American history. And one would think that he could, you know, get into a kind of cynical view of our history and our culture. But he says, you know, it's really important to be an optimist, that if you're just focused on what's wrong, then you don't have the energy to act. But if you see in the context of all the goodness in life and all the goodness in people and the acts of compassion and courage and love, then that inspires you. That gives you energy to act and make a difference in the world. Otherwise, you just throw in the towel before you start. So I really see it as essential to come from a place of love and gratitude for life, celebrating what we do have, so it's worth working for and make it a better world.
Mm. Well, that sounds, you know, just almost common sense and really indisputable.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly we can be a source of something healthier by being happy, but being happy wouldn't really be enough necessarily, would it? I mean, we certainly all have encountered people who seem to be pretty up and cheerful,
yeah,
but who don't really seem to be very connected to the larger world. And
mm-hmm.
So somehow, is it a deeper kind of happiness?
Oh, yeah.
Not only, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not talking about, like I said, you know, pasting a smiley smile on your face and say, you know, what's the old song, forget your troubles, come on, get happy. That's not going to do it. But to find a deeper source of happiness and well-being, which is based, as I share in the book or in the course, where the subtitle is 10 Steps That Will Put You on the Road to Real Happiness. And those are aligned with a place in our heart that is really wanting well-being, but sometimes gets misguided in thinking happiness is getting as much as I can, as quickly as I can, or getting a quick hit of pleasure. And that's not what I'm talking about. There are what in Buddhist practice are called wholesome states, states like compassion or love, loving yourself, loving others, or like equanimity and peace, or gratitude, or being aligned with your values and acting with integrity. Those states open the heart. They expand the heart that are very different than going for as much as you can, which is a state of contraction in the wanting mind. So when you're in touch with a deeper source of happiness, then you radiate out a feeling of well-being. You know, when you're around somebody who just really really emanates a feeling of love, it wakes that up in you. In positive psychology, there's this phenomenon called the elevation response. I think this guy, Jonathan Haidt, coined it from Harvard. He says, and anybody knows this to be so, when you see somebody do something inspiring, it inspires you. It inspires you to be moved, and inspires you even to act. You know, you see firefighters going in to rescue people that they don't know, or in disasters, it brings out the best in people. That we get inspired, we get elevated, because we have these mirror neurons in our brains that say, "Oh yeah, that is really that's really moving that people can care like that." And so, those kinds of states that open the heart, that have a feeling of connection with life, are the ones that are, I think, most effective to then be a source of whatever action we do. I'm thinking actually something, a good example of this is like, probably most people listening are familiar with the movie The An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's movie on climate change. And the brilliant thing in that movie, you know, we hear about climate change and it can scare the daylights out of us, but the director made Al Gore, besides telling the facts, he said, "I want you to let people know why you're doing this, how much you love this planet." And it was a beautiful thread through the whole movie, seeing scenes of nature and seeing breathtaking panoramas and animals and really touching the heart as Gore was saying, "Don't you love life? Isn't this worth working for? Isn't it amazing, this planet that we have been blessed with?" That gets people, I know it got me moving, just, wow, yeah, I really do love life. That's very mobilizing and very magnetizing, and that's kind of where I'm coming from, why getting in touch with an open heart is so effective a source of change.
Yes, I really resonate with that. It seems to me that one of the things that is challenging to me personally, and certainly I've seen it be challenging to many of the people I've been in dialogue with, my own students and clients, but even some of the guests on this series, is that when we look unflinchingly at the facts of what's happening in our world, it can be pretty discouraging, and we can find ourselves slipping from that place of positive, inspired care to a kind of anxious overwhelm that is emotionally in deficit. And I certainly feel how as soon as that tinges my motivation and my orientation, the whole quality of the energy that I bring to bear is disturbing to other people instead of strength-giving. And that hinge in my own heart and in my own being seems to be a critical factor in my ability to be a positive change agent, a resource to the people who resonate with me. And yet this life is challenging, and we all are faced with things that frighten us or that worry us or that bring up our anxieties, and that there's a little bit of a struggle going on in every human heart to find our way back to that joyful place even in the midst of sometimes very discouraging and disappointing and even really frightening information that we have to find a way to integrate.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, and, you know, I teach Buddhist philosophy and meditation. It starts, the Buddhist teachings starts with the fact that there's suffering in life. That's the first noble truth. And he said, if the more you understand and the less you're afraid of that, the more you can come to the end of suffering. He said, I teach about suffering and the end of suffering. And if we are not able to process our fear, our despair, our doubts, then they are running us. And so an essential piece is to get in touch with your despair and your fear and your anger and your outrage. All of those things are part of being human. If you're not angry or outraged at some of the things that go on that you read in the newspapers, then you're probably not alive or not very in touch with your heart. But there's a difference between feeling those and going deeper and not stopping there in your reaction. All the anger and all the outrage and all the fear is really, when I go deeper, is based on the fact that we do care, that we do want things to be better, that we do want a safe planet for ourselves and our families and our children, children's children. To get underneath the anger and the fear and to get in touch with a place of love and care, then you're hitting pay dirt. You're getting from a place that that is expansive and as I say, very contagious. Because we all have that care. So it's essential. And whether or not we can make a difference, who knows if we can make a difference? Who is it? Thomas Merton saying that you have to come to terms with the fact that what you do may be ultimately fruitless. And if you're doing it with hope of results, you're going to get into trouble. But you do it just because of the rightness of it. And you do it because it's what motivates you. So without carrying the world on your shoulders, you do it out of that love. And that's much less of a burden. And that means you're doing your part and somebody else will do their part when they are inspired by you.
Mm. Yeah, that really resonates.
There's another thought that just occurred to me. There's a Talmudic teaching that says, if the world were ending and you knew that nothing would make a difference, you still do what's most aligned with your heart's deepest values. Because if you're living with integrity and responding to circumstances in the way that really opens your heart, then there's a possibility of doing it with joy.
Mm. Well, that certainly resonates for me. In fact, many of the folks listening may remember a blog post I posted here called Finding Your Yes, where I contemplated that very question. You know, even if we're past the point of no return and we're just... I'd say fated to live in a time where the human species passes some irretrievable point of no return that takes us to some sort of dark age. What is it that, you know, how do we want to live? And if you can find a yes to the idea of going and doing whatever it is that you can do to be the expression of love and life and that which could have turned the corner if it were possible, you know, mm-hmm. that would have manifested that next evolution of the human species and the human spirit, that could have manifested that which could have met the challenges, that if you can feel enough inspiration in that to go on, even under the worst case scenario, then really you've met that essential existential question in a fundamental way. And in a sense, you become bulletproof. You're home free. But of course, then every morning you have to wake up and you have to deal with loss and you have to deal with pain and you have to deal with sometimes really confusing losses, injustice and distortion. You have to deal with others perceiving you as if you were something that you're not, or discovering that your own mixed motives have created karmas even where you've tried to be a source of love and clarity. And to continually engage both the, you might say, fighting the good fight in the outer world of really trying to be a presence of integrity and love and of something truly positive and life-giving, but then also this inner battle that helps us to come forth in the midst of pain and loss and all the things that would embitter our hearts and draw us to a place of anxiety and resentment and confusion, mm-hmm. and find our way to the kind of sanity that our essential happiness gives us. That I think what I feel most aligned to in your unique teaching is the appreciation that we do need to keep fighting that inner fight toward, you know, to rediscover the happiness that's always really our nature, that's there in just enjoying a full breath in this very moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you touch on a few different points there. First of all, gratitude for what you do have is really a key to keeping the heart open. Einstein has this line, there's two ways to go through this life. One is as if nothing is a miracle, and the other is as if everything is a miracle. And the more you can open up to the second, just, wow, it's you're alive. What does that mean? How did you get to be alive? Life coming together through this form called James or Terry, isn't that amazing? And not to miss out on the subtleties and the profundity of the fact that you're alive and all the miracles that are happening all around you that are part of that. But then you also, you touch on the different motives that you have. You know, unless we're finished with our work, we have mixed intentions, and we have nobility, and we have ignobility, if there's such a word. And to really see, to stay in touch with your highest aspirations, even if there's mixed motives. This is a teaching that I found very helpful. It's like you might do something with a good intention, maybe 90% good intention and 10% out of frustration or anger, or maybe hoping to be recognized or some kind of payoff in there. And in your self-awareness, if you focus on, oh, you know, look at the ulterior motive there, you know, what a phony I was. If you just focus on that, then then that becomes your whole reality, and you've just dissolved the 90% good intention. But if you stay focused on where you're coming from, that it feels so good to come from a place of goodness of heart, knowing, 10% is not so wholesome, you don't have to focus on the 10%. Focus on the good intention, and the other takes care of itself. Even if it's 50-50 and you focus on the good intention, the other 50 takes care of itself. Even if it's 10-90 and you focus on how good it feels to come from a place of love, you're going in the right direction. So, there's an inner battle going on. It doesn't have to be a battle if you know where to place your attention. And then another point you make as far as how to deal with the suffering around us, that it can lead to bitterness, or it can lead to expressing your compassion. It's true. It could go either way. And that's where it's so powerful to be exposed to teachings that can move you towards more connection and opening. One of the main teachings that I love in the Buddha's teaching is this esoteric teaching, not so esoteric, but it's not so well known. It's called Transcendental Dependent Arising, and anyone can Google it. There's a great treatise on it that this wonderful monk Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote, Transcendental Dependent Arising, where the Buddha says that suffering starts out with suffering. He says suffering can be the causative factor for faith to arise. And when you think about how many people have been motivated by their own suffering to look for answers to the world, you see that there's some validity to what he's saying. Suffering can lead to faith. Faith can lead to gladness. Gladness can lead to joy. Joy can lead to tranquility, happiness, contentment, all the way up to the highest stages of freedom. So we have a choice right there, that how we deal with our suffering will either contract us into more bitterness and frustration and anger or hopelessness, or it can lead to a faith in something way beyond what our comprehension can be, and align with that.
I'm sort of, as I feel into this, I'm imagining that many of the people listening to this now, or even later via recording, are going to be kind of, I'm with you. That really feels right.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's several questions that might come up about, well, yes, but how do I regain this when I've lost it, or how do I maintain this? But then there's another line of questions, I think, that go on along the lines of, okay, but let's say that we are in this place of being in touch with the inherent joy of existence. It can be kind of hard not to go into a kind of denialism. Isn't there another muscle that I have to exercise to really look things in the face and see them for what they are, and be caringly related to all the suffering that is here in the world, and be and not be in some way making myself immune or being in denial? Isn't that a second set of muscles that I also need to learn to exercise, even as I'm dwelling with the inherent joy of existence?
Mm-hmm.
And isn't how do you relate to that, or is that just a natural outgrowth of our connectedness to
it? Is, yeah. I mean, that's as those familiar with Buddhist teachings, it's about wisdom and compassion. On the one hand, there's a show going on that we don't have to take seriously. It's all an illusion. And on the other, it's the only game in town. So what are you going to do about it? And that's where, in the relative reality, compassion is the ultimate expression of understanding interconnectedness. that compassion is actually, in the teachings, it's one of four sublime states, what are called the Brahma-viharas, which include loving-kindness and joy and equanimity and compassion. Compassion is a loving heart in the face of suffering. So suffering is actually a prerequisite for this sublime state. I always find that kind of interesting. It's not that suffering is sublime. Suffering is not sublime. But what it does, it evokes this inherent capacity to care. And caring is a sublime state. That we are moved when we see others around us in need or having a hard time, that place that softens, that feels connected, that's different from pity, that's different from feeling, oh, that's so terrible, boy, I'm glad it doesn't happen to me. Pity or grief where you're bereft, but to learn to keep your heart open in the face of suffering. And then what naturally happens is, if you're present and are in touch, then you want to respond. Compassion is a verb. And that actually is what not only ennobles us, but it relieves our own suffering. I love a line from one inspiring teacher, Angie Arian, who says, action absorbs anxiety. That when we're just stuck in our, oh, this is so terrible, we've got no place for that to go. But if we can express our caring and do something positive, not to take away somebody's suffering if we can't, or rescue them when it's not in our capacity, but to do something that expresses our caring heart, that's where the great relief is, and that's where we honor our interconnectedness. So it's really the culmination of a wise heart.
So then we're really kind of getting into what my friends at the Institute of Heart Math would probably call the higher calculus of the math of the heart here, in the sense of, so if I am really doing this work at this heart level, mm-hmm. and I'm recovering my sanity, my connection to the inherent goodness of being alive, and a kind of gratitude for the fact that I'm here, you know, my back may hurt, I may have lost a loved one, I may have, I may even know that I, you know, maybe I even have a terminal diagnosis or something, you know, but I'm here, I'm alive, and there's a goodness in that, and I'm in touch with that. Mm-hmm. And then I'm in touch also with the suffering of others, and I'm in touch with the fact that my caring for them is, that's a good thing too. The fact that I care is good, and the fact that my compassion is welling up, that there's something inherently ecstatic or joyful in that I am a caring being. And then if I really engage with that in a way that is alive, then I notice there are ways that I can enact that, and that too is a source of joy and strength and clarity. And in some sense, if I kind of keep my attention in this sacred fire of the inherent goodness of being, the joy that is there in being alive, the joy that is there in caring, the joy that is present in facing the facts, in not looking away from anything, in being courageous enough to be present to all the seemingly overwhelming complexities of life, there's a kind of integrity, and in a sense it keeps feeding on itself, and therefore the motives that the energy with which I can be a change agent or an activist or a force of love in the lives of other people is still sourced in this inherent healthy positivity of existence. Is that essentially your understanding of the Dharma?
Yeah, one aspect of the Dharma, absolutely. I think you got it. You know, there's the relative and the absolute. And on the relative level, being here in the in this world, we're connected. Everything affects everything else. And the more we are awake to the suffering around us as well as the joys, the more we naturally want to respond, the more we, if we're in touch with what brings true happiness, we want to make a difference. I mean, there's a price to pay for cutting ourselves off and not caring. You know, I don't care. Okay, good luck. I hope you enjoy your life. If you don't care, there's something that diminishes your aliveness and humanity. So it's a real fruition of an awakened heart.
Go ahead.
I was going to say the trick is to find the balance between caring and not being overwhelmed, which is the other side of things. You know, there, of course, there's so much suffering. One can get feel there's no end to the suffering. How can I make a difference? Or, gosh, if I really open up my heart to it all, it'll just be too much to take in. And that's something to be respected as well. And that's where caring, compassion, is balanced by equanimity. That's the magical magical balance act. T.S. Eliot has this line in the Four Quartets. He says, "Teach me to care and not to care," and to find the balance between caring and allowing things are the way they are. You know, it's like the old serenity prayer: grant me the courage to change the things I can, and the serenity to accept the things I can't, and the wisdom to know the difference. Well, there needs to be a coming to terms with, oh, this is how it is, and I'll do whatever I can that feels right, but not be overwhelmed in the process, and just, there's a much bigger perspective that one can bring to life in that equanimity, cultivation of equanimity that allows the heart to not be completely broken.
And this, you know, one of the things that I kind of wonder about is that in the world of form, and in the literature about that, you know, there's a lot of different literature about being a peak performer or about being a success and a happy person in life. You know, this is the kind of the Western tradition that comes from Ben Franklin, you know, including Napoleon Hill or Tony Robbins and all of that. There's kind of a point of view. One of the truths that's taught in that tradition is, has to do with kind of swinging for the fences, that you don't really accomplish anything here in the world of form unless you find a kind of transcendental source for the energy that you bring, and you give it that extra level of commitment, that you're willing, in a sense, to really give it your all, to give it your 110%, so to speak. And I wonder if there's, you know, I think when we conceive of that, often we think of it in a way that is all about striving and all about all our attention being rooted in a in a in in a commitment to getting certain results.
Right.
But perhaps it could be that we might find the same source for that apparently supernormal level of energy being brought to the relative world in a kind of equanimity, not just in an attachment to outcome, but in a freedom from attachment to outcome. Is that something you've contemplated, James?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not about, I mean, sure, you might have a vision and an idea of what you want to accomplish, either personally or in relationship to the world around you. But as it said, all of karma is based on intention. And so it's not so much the results, and what you can do is be inspired to move from a place of caring and do your part without seeing if you've passed or failed your test. Like the Dalai Lama says, you know, world systems come and go, and we might not make it, but you want to do your part so that when you look back, you say, I did the best I can, and your sincere intention, your sincere motivation, that's your greatest protection. So it's really staying aligned with the intention that speaks to you, and I feel that besides our personal goals, that if we widen our intention so that it's aligned with a spirit of contribution, then that's getting much closer to true inspiration, that you let that be the source of your actions rather than did I get there yet or not, because all that does is contract the heart and feel frustration rather than, you know, even if you do get to your goal, until there's peace on earth, goodwill towards all humanity, there's more work to be done. So it's more a matter of just facing in that direction and letting your heart lead the way out of caring.
Mm-hmm. And you've really, you know, this is what you prayed, this is what you practiced, this is how you've lived your life, and you have become more and more presence of a kind of bubbling up of joy. And I think it might be really, really helpful to people if you talked about how this heart practice and this orientation to that kind of inherent goodness and kindness and compassionate, you know, compassion, I guess, relative bodhicitta rooted in absolute bodhicitta, you know, how this practice that you advocate and describe and practice yourself, how it unfolds over the years, how it isn't just a static place of feeling pretty good that you keep returning to, but how it is a gift that, you know, keeps giving even more deeply, it keeps revealing itself more fully. I'm curious to hear you talk about that.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, first, you know, truth in advertising. I wasn't always an optimistic, happy person. I hate to say, I'm a joyful person. The word joy is a bit of a stretch for a whole lot of people. Sometimes they say, joy, give me a break. I'll take not being miserable. But I wasn't always, I was actually pretty cynical, growing up and just didn't think that things would work out, or I should say pessimistic. And, at some point I saw that I was kind of creating my own self-fulfilling prophecy and that I could, go in a different direction. And when I, found the teachings, like I said, that really did help steer me in a whole new direction, and I believed in the possibility of opening to the well-being inside. And when I look at myself and everybody around, we all want to be happy. Do you know anybody who doesn't want to be happy? And sometimes I, when I'm talking to an audience and I say, anybody here not want to be happy? And I say, I know if you're feeling like you're fighting, raising your hand, saying, yeah, I like being grumpy. Well, that's just your way of being happy. So there's this place inside of us that is moving towards well-being in most everything we do, although we can be misguided at times. So this is just activating this place inside of us that truly does want to be happy. And then getting clear on our intention. For me, it was saying, okay, I really want to go for well-being. I've had enough of insecurity and depression and feeling feeling that things won't work out. And I want to face in the direction of greater happiness. Now, it's not like all of a sudden you make that decision and it's all figured out. There's conditioning that I still work with. You know, if press the right button and I can be back in the third grade in feeling young and insecure, it doesn't last for very long. It's very different now than it was 35 years ago. But, you know, those patterns of conditioning, they can still be there. But when you get clear on your intention to face in the direction of greater well-being and happiness, then that starts the whole process going. And then being as present as one can for one's life, being mindful, you know, which is the heart of the meditation that I teach. And then what I found in looking at the teachings, Buddhist teachings, and what I try to teach in the course, is that the Buddha said, take a look at the different states of mind. There are unwholesome states that lead to suffering, and there are wholesome states that lead to happiness. He says, overcome or guard against the unwholesome states. And when there's a wholesome state, cultivate it, and when it's there, to maintain it and increase it. Not by trying to grab onto it and get attached, but just by being very present with it. And he says that there's a gladness that's connected with the wholesome state. Like, for instance, he gives the example, you might be moved to be generous. And this is in one of the discourses. He says, if you're in the middle of a generous act, then you say, oh, I'm being generous now. How wonderful. And letting yourself feel that generosity as it moves through you. And he says, pay attention to that. Pay attention to that wholesome state, because that gladness opens the heart. So the more you can notice moments of well-being, the more you can open up to the goodness in life, which is also corroborated in modern neuroscience as well, that when you pay attention to those moments of well-being, you're actually rearranging your neural pathways. Even if you've had a lifetime of seeing what's wrong, you start to shift little by little. So what I teach and try to practice is, along with being open to the hard stuff, not to miss all the good stuff.
Mm. One of the things that that I teach in my course in integral spiritual practice is what I call the good news, which is to get in touch with this kind of inherent goodness, inherent beauty, inherent freedom, inherent loving nature of existence itself. And that at times that can seem abstract and theoretical, and that it's really very congruent with what you teach, that there's a noticing of our you might say, our healthy motivation or our wholesome states, and an emphasizing of them to where there's a growing relationship with that which is their source, that there is something about beauty that transcends mere subjective, you know, one man's meat's another man's poison kind of relativism,
mm-hmm.
wherein all of us have something in us, who knows what it is, that we recognize beauty. And when I point to something beautiful and you look at it, something in you is likely to recognize as beautiful the same thing I recognize as beautiful. And there's a kind of teleology of beauty, that it's an attractor, and goodness is an attractor, and truth and love and freedom. These are attractive values that are drawing us, and that if we look at the churn of life, very often these wonderful values are crushed under the cruelties of, you know, that life does make, you know, does crush us and crush our higher values, but they keep springing ever green, and that somehow if we stay related to that and if we continually resource ourselves in those inherent values, we become their presence in life. We're being that which we wish to see outside ourselves, instead of only being disappointed that we don't see more of it outside ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's true. We are sponges for goodness and truth and beauty. That's why we love going to the movies and rooting for the hero or the heroine, saying, "Come on, you can do it," and we love fairness, and when things are there's an injustice, it's disconcerting, and it takes us out of alignment. We love for things to be resolved in fairness and goodness and truth. So it's really just accessing that place that's so deep in us that wants to see it. Now, here's another practice that for me is essential around this. It's the heart of my practice that I've been doing for decades. The basic instruction that I was inspired by Neem Karoli Baba, who is Ram Dass's guru and somebody who has inspired me, he would say, keep looking for the good. And if you look for the good, even if you know all the awful stuff, this is now my words, not his, you'll find it, and you'll be more likely to find it. And if you think of being in a room where somebody might come in and you sense that they're seeing all your weaknesses and flaws and they're judging you, how do you feel? You feel flawed or small or defensive. Somebody else can come into that room and know all your flaws, but you sense they're seeing how beautiful you are. How do you feel? You feel beautiful. So we have a very powerful capacity to draw right out of others what we look for. It's not just that we're putting on rose-colored glasses, but we're actually, if you can speak to the goodness in another human being and really see it, you actually invite it out. So that's a very powerful principle that has made a huge effect in my life.
Inviting out the goodness around us simply by being attentive to it and seeing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. Mm-hmm. Well, I would love to keep going here, but it's that time, and I know a lot of the folks listening online live have questions for you too, and I have a couple of important announcements. So if you have a question for James or me, please just send that question by typing it into the instant teleseminar window on your computer. And if you phoned in, please just press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. James has created this 10-month experiential course to develop your natural capacity for happiness and well-being. Over 10,000 people have taken it worldwide. It's really quite remarkable. It's been featured in O Magazine, the Oprah Magazine, and in many other publications, Tricycle, Huffington Post. The participant comments about it are just incredible, and you can see them on the website. This course is available live and in person in the San Francisco Bay Area. The meetings are in Berkeley. And also, it's available via video and audio stream online. The course is grounded in modern science and ancient wisdom. It's not fluff, and very honestly faces the hard parts of life while also exploring the healing and refueling and awakening powers of joy. So you can find out more about that at awakeningjoy.info. That's awakeningjoy.info. If you're interested in my work, I've recently posted an important blog post called Occupy Integral that you can find at beamsandstruts.com. And this coming weekend, a week from this weekend right now, I'm going to be offering a weekend seminar called Encountering the Beloved in New York City. That's March 3rd and 4th. And then on June 15th through 20th, I'll be offering a 5-day deep experiential seminar at Hollyhock Farm in British Columbia, Canada. You can find out more details about both of these. Also learn more about my work by going to integralspiritualpractice.com. It's also reachable by typing in terrypatton.com. Please stay on the line at the end of the call, and I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with our upcoming guests. And I've got a lot to tell you there. Briefly, on March 11th, I'll be talking with Drew Dellinger, poet and activist, on Love Letter to the Milky Way, which is the title of his new book. And then we'll open up the lines so we can hear some of each other's voices as we say goodbye. Okay, let's see. What have we got here in terms of questions? Cassandra in Coarse Gold, I think that's in British Columbia, asks, I have such an appreciation for the miracle of life. I'm extremely grateful for so many things, even the very small things that others might easily overlook. My heart is open and full of compassion for others and myself. However, I have to admit, I'm not grateful for being alive. I never have been. I yearn for that experience, but it's just not there. Would you please comment on that?
I wish I could have a live conversation so we could just go in a little bit deeper. Well, if you have a gratitude for all the things around you and the miracle of life, one thing to reflect on is that how are you able to appreciate it? The only way you're able to appreciate it is because you're alive. That somehow you've been given this consciousness, or this consciousness has arisen within you, that's let you appreciate it. And maybe to just start, that's enough, that you are an agent of appreciation of all the life around you. And if you say you have such an appreciation, your heart is touched by all the things around you, well then maybe that can be your purpose, to be an appreciator of the life around you and appreciate that you have been given that capacity to appreciate. there's something in the teachings that that might also support your gratitude for being alive, and that is to contemplate death regularly. The Buddha said it's one of the things to reflect on every day, the fact that we are, that we will become old, that we will be sick, that we will die, that everything and everyone near and dear to us will be separated from us, and that we are the owners of our karma. And he said the more you can really wake up to that fact, not to be morbid or depress yourself, but to appreciate the fact that you're just here for a very short time, and you don't want to miss it, that can be a real support to making every moment count. And I would, if you don't have a meditation practice, I would really encourage you to experiment with one, because what that does is it refines your capacity to be present for each moment, instead of the way we usually do, distracting ourselves with things outside of ourselves. So it's kind of turning the lens inward and seeing, oh, there's a whole universe in here. There's a whole arena of aliveness right in here. So without knowing anything more, those things I would suggest: meditation practice, reflecting on your mortality, and being an agent of appreciation for the life around you.
Mm. Beautiful. Thank you, James.
Thanks.
I want to bring on a live caller here. This is
great.
Someone, I don't have a name, but I think you're calling on a cell phone from Taos, New Mexico, and you're live. Please introduce yourself.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Hi.
You know, this is so, you guys
what,
are speaking so directly. Karina.
Hi, Karina.
Hi, Karina. Welcome.
Thanks. You are speaking so directly to what I'm experiencing at the moment. And I would say from my own personal experience that what you're describing is possible because of all those years that we take it so seriously.
Mm.
I, from my own personal experience, I would say that, you know, I've been a very serious soul. Sri Aurobindo is my teacher, and my nose is to the grindstone, and I've been there. And all of a sudden, I can appreciate what you're saying, because I did all those years of work, of the seriousness. Now, I feel that I've reached a place where I can express that joy because I found it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a search to find it. So I'm just possibly saying, is this something that is the next step on the journey that we're on?
Mm-hmm. Well put, and I'm glad that you're coming into that new chapter of feeling the joy and the connection with life in a new way after all the years. And for me, I'd say it both. I think there's no way around getting into not only no way around, that it's part of the process to go through our own dark nights of the soul, as they say. It's the hero's journey, where you need to face at some point your fears and your doubts. And it's not just a smooth sail into the sunset. I do think that sometimes we can have a skewed perspective on what the spiritual journey can mean, and we can get stuck for a while in being more serious than we need to. Just if we, like I did, distort some teachings. So you know, right now, actually, I'm in the middle of teaching a month-long retreat at Spirit Rock, a silent meditation retreat. This is my day off. And there's 80 people there who are doing very profound inner work, and they are both seeing the parts in their hearts and their minds that are challenging to open up to, and they're also seeing all the moments of goodness and well-being as well. So I think you're right in saying, yeah, one has to go through some hard, challenging times, and also you can remember along the way that life is a blessing, so that I think they can go hand in hand and support each other too.
Right, great. Well, thank you. I totally understand exactly what you're saying.
Great. Well, nice talking to you.
You too. Be well.
Bye bye.
Bye.
Thank you. We have a number of questions that people have asked. Here's one that's kind of a little different. I'm curious what you have to say about this too. This is from Germaine from Saint Rose du Lac. I think that's maybe in Quebec, and she asks, "I've recently been part of a weekend seminar on laughter yoga. How do you see the place of laughter in awakening joy?"
That's great. Actually, I have a friend who's come in on the classes, the live classes, who's a laughter yoga teacher, and sometimes gets everybody into the laughter practice. I think it's great. I think it's really great. I think it's kind of amazing how we can find the right button, even if it's at first forced, you know, ha ha he he, like that, and it just seems like, oh, come on, what is that about? And yet, often we just need some encouragement to let ourselves free enough to laugh. Kids laugh all the time, and I think there's something really valuable about laughter. It keeps us from taking life too seriously, and also having a sense of humor about life, because as my friend Wes Nisker says, if you can't laugh, it's just not funny. And we can get very serious. So what I see humor as being is a perspective where we don't take things so seriously, and it breaks us out of the contraction that can so easily develop when we are weighted down by the problems of the world. So I think laughter yoga is great.
Great. There's another question, very practical question. Terry Hunt from Holden Beach asks, can we start the Awakening Joy course late? I checked online. I see it starts the first week of February.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's people that are signing up all the time these next month or two. It's done. All the materials. We've only met once so far. We're going to have the second live meeting later on this week, and the second month's practice will be up within the week, and all the materials are up there, and you can just catch up. It's nice to do it with a friend if you can, because that makes that's a really good support for going through the practices. And the book that I wrote, Awakening Joy, goes along with it, and all the material is in there in the book. But I send out two practice letters a month on the particular month's theme, and then there's the video and the audio of the live classes that are up on the website for you to view or listen to at your own leisure. And while I'm at it, just mention that although there's a suggested donation, pretty modest suggested donation, anybody can offer whatever they want to do the course. I just want to share it with as many people as sincerely want to work with the principles and practices. So please join us.
Beautiful. Thanks, James. I see that there's another person with his hand up. This is from Wayne, Michigan. I'm not sure if this might be Sam, but you're live. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, how's it going?
Hi.
Well, I just want to say I appreciate kind of bathing in the meditation here, you know, because with last time with the transcendental meditation, which I was overjoyed to be a part of, you know, and now this, because a lot of it is, you know, there's not a lot of opportunity to practice this meditation, you know, just in general. I mean, you can find it on the internet or Wikipedia or whatever, but not a lot of real opportunity to practice. Mm-hmm. And transcendental meditation costs quite a bit, you know, and all that. So it's kind of difficult, but I do think that the pressure of needing to understand this meditation now is being overtaken by the curiosity that's cultivated by these calls, you know, and remaining in the mystery more so than, okay, what's possible now that I don't have these resources or it's limited or whatever, you know. And I think that at that point, integral is really starting to work for me in my experience, and it's helping me to get out of my head more and into a lot of the other lines of development, I think, that I haven't been looking at in the shadow and things, which are issues really for anybody, for all of us on these calls. But something seems to be clicking for me, and it really seems to be working, so I just want to show my appreciation once again and, you know, really just say thank you for being here and for supporting the whatever's unfolding here, because it's really doing me a great service, and I'm sure that it's doing everybody else a service as well. And I think it's what you put into it is what you get out of it. That's what I'm finding. So thank you.
Great.
And I hope everybody's doing good, you know. It's a lot of pressure lately, and especially with the blog post and stuff, but where there's hope and sunshine and, you know, all that.
Keep looking for the
that
good.
There's a ski trip for me next weekend personally, so that's what I'm getting stoked for. It's awesome. Got to do something with these Michigan winters.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Sam. We have another question from Christy in Denver, who asks if you might speak about the possibility for those who are just embarking on their spiritual journeys, how quickly or slowly elevating their awareness, well-being, and happiness can be. If someone is over 30, over 40, over 50, or beyond, and maybe doesn't have 35 years to get to a level of being that you two have achieved. Some may feel discouraged to begin or really believe that they can change how they organize their lives due to continuing, you know, to continue working toward a higher state. Or maybe they need to leave that for people who are younger, you know, that are they old dogs who can't learn new tricks, I think she may be also asking.
I would say start right where you are. It's never too late, and that would be an unfortunate belief to take on that it's too late and how could I change. I'll say a couple of things on that. First of all, when you look at the alternative, living with more greed, hatred, and delusion, or developing more awareness and kindness and compassion and love coming out of clarity and wisdom, it seems to be a no-brainer for me. So the idea is not so much, oh, can I catch up to everybody, but how good it feels to be facing in the right direction and be aligned with your higher values and what really moves you and inspires you. So that's the first thing. It's never too late. And there's people on this retreat that I'm teaching now. There's one fellow in his 80s who's relatively new to this practice. So, yeah, don't sell yourself short. People, everybody has their own trajectory, and somebody can, after a lifetime of being in one mode, see the light and see, okay, I'm ready to make a change and have a very, very quick shift in their whole perspective. And I'll tell you one story that's on a more personal story that attests to this, and that's my mom, who I write about in the book. And actually, you can go on YouTube. She's very funny. If you go in and if you put in "Confessions of a Jewish Mother," and the subtitle is "How my son ruined my life," but if you just put in "Confessions of a Jewish Mother," that'll do it. And it's the story when I was writing the book, and she was 89 at the time. She's now 93. And she's a very, by nature, pessimistic complainer, kvetch, she says, as they call it in Yiddish. And I was visiting her. We were she lives in Los Angeles, and I live in Berkeley. And I came down for a week while my sister was out of town, and to spend some time with my mom. And I was writing about gratitude, and I was seeing, I was looking at all this research, this incredible research about the power of gratitude to make you feel better, uplift your spirit and your heart and your physical and mental well-being. And I said, "Pretty impressive." She said, "Yeah, very." And I said, "Mom, wouldn't it be great to do a gratitude practice?" And she said, "Look, James, dear, I know my life is very blessed, but I've been complaining my whole life, and I don't think I can change right now." And I said, "Mom, if you could, would you change?" She said, "Yeah, if I could, I would, but I don't think I can." And I said, "Okay, let's play a game. Every time you complain, I'll just remind you, and you say, 'And my life is very blessed.'" Like, for instance, she might say, "Oh, it's so cold here in Marina del Rey," right? And I say, "And, oh yeah, and my life is blessed." And she has the kind of moxie that says, "Okay, let's play it." We played it. It was the greatest week. I had so many opportunities because the complaints would just roll off her tongue, you know, "Oh, this is wrong. And, oh yeah, yeah." And amazingly, it took hold. I called her a lot when I got back home, and a friend carried on the game with her. My sister, when she came back a few weeks later, her first comment was, "What did you do to Mom?" Because it took hold. And now this is 4 years later, and almost a minute doesn't go by in our conversations where she says, "I'm so blessed. We're so blessed. I'm so contented." If you would have told me that my mother could be saying that 4 years ago after a lifetime of complaining, I would have not given you any odds on that at all. I can see it's possible to change. It's the greatest gift of doing this whole Awakening Joy course, to see my mother actually is grateful and changed. And she's inspired so many people since then. So I hope that can inspire you too.
I find myself just smiling. I've watched that wonderful YouTube video of your mom, and she's a totally charming character. And I can just imagine how happy it makes you feel to see her becoming more and more grateful and happy. It's really a unreasonable blessing to have that in your life.
It's the best. check out the video if you haven't, Confessions of a Jewish Mother, and show it to your parents or anybody who's a complainer in your life. It might rub off. She's become a teacher of gratitude in her old life. She says,
you know,
how many views are we up to now?
I don't know. James in Sacramento asks kind of the other side of this. He asks, as a parent, how can we raise our children to view happiness? Mm. Or how can we teach them about it in their early years of development?
Well, of course, the most obvious and probably the most important answer is modeling it yourself, because what you do will model, will inspire them and rub off on them one way or another. When my son Adam, who's now 25, was old enough, for instance, to read the clock hands or read the numbers, and I'd say, I need to take a few minutes to myself, I need a time out. And he knew that I'd sometimes go and meditate for 10 minutes if it was just the two of us, if his mom was out, and we were alone, or to just point out all the goodness in life, or every time that they're happy, to give energy to it and support their happiness and play with them. The more you can play with them, you get the benefit of that as well as they do. And when they're frightened, I used to do this with my son when he'd have a meltdown when he was like, you know, 3 or 4. I did a little loving kindness, and I'd hold him, and I'd say, do you want me to tell the people who love you? And he'd say, yeah. And then I'd hold him, and I'd say, Mommy loves you, and Daddy loves you, and Grandma loves you, and Aunt Susan loves you. And he'd just little by little start to relax. So there's lots of different practices that you can do. But mostly just find well-being within yourself and stay tuned to it and see their own goodness. The more you see it and look for it and celebrate their joy, the more you're accentuating those qualities in them.
Beautiful. Thank you, James. There's another live caller. We're pretty much getting to the end of our time, but I want to give you a chance maybe quickly to ask a question. You're calling in on a 720 area code, Denver, Colorado, Patterson, I think.
Hi there. It's Melanie. Actually, Melanie with a Denver number in Miami at the moment where I'm visiting. Thank you so much. This has just underlined and confirmed and contrasted a lot of stuff for me today. I'm deeply grateful. Within the last couple of weeks, it came to me that I had been living my whole life from a place of finding out what's wrong, like you do when you try to childproof a house, you know, or the electric things in the receptacle, and finding what's wrong with everything, and the realization of that, and then of course that let me have something to fix. And the way that showed up in my children's lives was that they thought that they weren't capable. So with this realization came an incredible sense in my body of relief that I don't have to do that, and it's become a practice now to do heart math. I'm teaching heart math, sharing it with people, and included it in my repertoire of practices, and allowing people the room for that inner thing you talked about to come forth. You know, they're modeling my own well-being, and so it becomes a contagion of well-being. And one of the things that reminds me when something is conditioning and programming and there's nothing to worry about, I heard a quote from a guy named Bayard Rustin, who was the Quaker behind Martin Luther King's civil rights movement. And Bayard used to say, to be afraid is to behave as if the truth is not the truth. And that just snaps me back into remembering that we are created in the image and likeness of that greater concept we call God. And I hope this is making sense. I'm realizing I have to invent new language for what I'm experiencing because the old language isn't adequate. But it's just so simple. It's just so simple, and I had made things so complicated that it was like carrying tons and tons of pounds of potatoes in a grocery bag all the time. And it's just a lovely relief. Lovely relief to just practice the heart math thing and know all is well. And I love the way you languaged, you know, cultivating and maintaining those wholesome states. I feel deep affection for you guys, and I'm so appreciative of the call today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Melanie.
Lots of blessings. Lots of blessings.
Thank you. I got you. Yeah, it's all what you look for.
Well, beautiful. There are a couple of really rich questions that have come in, but we're kind of at the end of our time. So apologies to those of you who've written in late with fantastic questions I wish I had time to ask. Before I tell you what's coming up next session and we open up our lines to say goodbye, a couple of reminders. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you want to learn more about James and his remarkable Awakening Joy course, please head to awakeningjoy.info, awakeningjoy.info. You're also invited to go to integralspiritualpractice.com to sign up for my personal mailing list and newsletter, and there you'll find out about my upcoming teaching events, including this weekend in New York and the five-day seminar I'll be leading in British Columbia, Canada, from June 15th to 20th. And now some details about what's coming up here. In 2 weeks, on March 11th, I'll be talking with the poet and sacred activist Drew Dellinger on the topic Love Letter to the Milky Way. On the 25th, I'll be speaking with the remarkable Austrian spiritual teacher Thomas Hubel. And then in April, the very clear, penetrating intelligence of Peter Baumann, formerly of Tangerine Dream and now the author of the remarkable new volume, Ego, the book. So thank you so much for joining James and me today. Let's open up our phone lines now so we can hear the voices of at least some of us, those who are on by phone. And we can all say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Wonderful.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Have a wonderful day. Goodbye.
Bye.